And I just wanted to thank the APHA for inviting me to be here, as well as the California Endowment, CPCA, and the California Wellness Foundation that funds our project. We also very graciously take in-kind donations. Cash would be nice. Visa, MasterCard, we'll take that too. I don't believe we take Discover. So I am just wanted to break the ice a little bit in part because I know it's hot in here, and I also noticed I've been on the other side of having to be in the audience, and when it gets a little warm without a cookie or without something to drink, you can get a little sleepy. So just be aware that if I toss out a question to you guys, it's not because I'm being mean, it's because that's the teacher in me and that's the advocacy in me as well. And I know you are all advocates of the groups that are here or people that are here. How many of you work with the immigrant population? Gracias. Thanks. Immigrants and the safety net. I just wanted to go over some statistics with you just so that you know about California. And I'm specifically talking about California because the Latino Coalition for Healthy California is a statewide organization. We've been in existence for 20 years. We're celebrating our 20th anniversary this year. Again, donations are welcomed. And so we focus primarily on the Latino population. In reality, it is the majority population here in California. And our emphasis is on healthcare policy, advocacy, research, and education. And hopefully I get kudos from my chair and my vice chair. Carmela is my vice chair, and you'll hear some of her comments are very similar to mine. We tag team frequently, not in the ring because she'd probably beat me, but in the our lecture arena. And so I'm very gracious and really happy to be number two. Talking before Carmela. So of the 38 million foreign-born people in California, in the United States, California is the greatest, is the home to the greatest number of immigrants or foreign-born people. And that's no surprise to us, right? You know, I don't think that's a surprise to any of us because we're right next to Mexico and a lot of folks fly in and out of LA as well as, you know, travel over the border. It's fairly easy to do. You have to wait a long time, but it is fairly easy to do. Of the estimated 7.5 million undocumented immigrants of Latino origin in the United States, 6.6 million are from Mexico. We just came back from Oaxaca, and the poverty there is just stifling. And so you can see and understand why many of them are seeking for better and bigger opportunities, and they look to the north where they see that that might be an option. Of those, many of them are, when they get here, are blended families. They end up marrying someone here, local. They end up having children that are citizen or end up bringing children from Mexico. And so they have blended families, is what we call them. Some of them may be undocumented or may be naturalized citizens, or their children may be citizens. California remains the leading destination for immigrants in the United States as a whole, receiving more than 325,000 new arrivals each year. The state's immigrant population now constitutes 27.2% of all residents and more than 9.9 million individuals. Again, we talked about the Latino population in California as being 37%. I believe it's higher. And of that population, 26 of it is immigrant. In the Central Valley alone, there's over 100 languages being spoken. We're talking about Mixteco, Triqui. We're talking about various types of Hmong languages and Southeast Asian languages. In addition to the Spanish that's also spoken. Of those, over 4 million Mexican immigrants currently live in California. 47 have no health insurance. 47% have no health insurance, and they live in poverty. Under the ACA, or the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, and I just give you a little bit of a statistics, according to California Watch, about 20% of the state's 1 million uninsured children will be left out because they or their parents are illegal immigrants. So where are they going to go? Where are they going? We heard a question from in the back. Where are they going to get their services? The services are going to come from the safety net clinics. In the Central Valley and other places in San Diego and other areas, you're going to see those folks going to those clinics. And the reason being is that they have to get care. We shouldn't have to be selective, but this is how the law is written. So as such, we need to ensure that the safety net clinics are secure and prosperous and aren't being reduced in funding. California, in California, 5.7 million Latinos will be newly eligible to purchase insurance on the exchange. Again, the NDOCs will not be able to, and they will not receive subsidies. An estimated 6.4 million Latinos in California will be newly eligible for coverage under Medi-Cal. Immigrants are unqualified for coverage, and if they have resided in California for less than 5 years, or if they are undocumented. And then here's a study that took place in 2007, and the authors estimate that under ACA, approximately 30,000 undocumented immigrant children will be barred from participating in health care benefits in newly established marketplace. 30,000 children, and you know and I know that those children that live in blended families, when those other children have either Medi-Cal or healthy families, they get the medicines that they need through their doctors, and it's shared amongst the family. How many of you come from large families? I'm one of those people, 9 in our family. And so if one of us got sick, my mom didn't take all of us. We use that one prescription for all 9 of us. And it's the same thing with the undocumented families. And we would hear calls from families saying, from the parents, how about my other kids? You know, my youngest ones have insurance, but how about the older ones that are not citizens? And how about us as parents? How can we get the medication, because we too are getting sick? So again, we recommend and acknowledge the fact that there's limitations within the law, but at the same time, we also let them know there are options, options such as the clinics. Okay, and then this is a nice little chart that I pulled up just so that you guys give you some color. And some make sure you're awake, but also kind of gives you a little bit of insight about the uninsured population. And it shows, if you look at the first one, citizen child, non-citizen, legal, permanent resident, it shows the statistics: 13%, 40.8%, and 38% of them are children. And if you keep going down, you'll see the non-citizens, child with no green card, 48.6%. Uninsured, all or part of the year. That's really striking. California's community clinics and public hospitals could continue to serve a significant number of uninsured immigrants even after full implementation of ACA. And as advocates, we need to look out for those folks, in part because they're the ones with no voice. And it's our efforts that raise those voices through our advocacy. The law will provide $11 billion in funding to community health clinics from 2011 to 2015. Carmela just presented at one of our regional meetings in L.A., and the struggle to get those monies from the state is just overwhelming. They give it to you, and how many have been in that boat, where they give you $300,000, and then they take it back, and they give you $100,000, and then they take that back, and you may get $25,000. So, you know, it's just a constant battle, and part of because of the economy that we're in, but for the clinics, we need to make sure, as an advocacy group, that we make sure that that effort is solid. Under ACA for the immigrants, no federal coverage, not allowed to purchase insurance, state insurance through the exchange, not eligible for premium tax credits or cost-sharing reductions. They're exempt from the individual mandate. They're not eligible for Medicare or non-emergency Medicaid or CHIP. The thing with emergency Medicare or emergency care, you need to be aware that if the doctor diagnoses the individual who goes in with an earache or a stomach ache as a non-emergency service, they're not going to cover it. So then the immigrant then has a medical debt that has to be dealt with. And that's where the other advocacy groups, the legal groups, or the health centers that are nonprofit advocacy groups are out there to help. And so those are the things that, unfortunately, a lot of people, when they get sick and they seek care and they think they can go to the emergency, they need to be really sure that the emergency is an emergency, because once that diagnosis comes back that it's not an emergency, then there is an issue, and they need to be aware of the things that they need to be able to advocate, such as charity care. The state may provide services to lawfully present immigrants without federal match, such as full-scope Medi-Cal for lawfully resident immigrants. There are programs to provide health services irrespective of immigration status, and these are some of them. I'm not going to go through all of them because I'm sure you all know what they are. I mean, Family Pack, Children's Health Initiatives. Many of them are still out there. The tribes are still out there and active. They're struggling as well with funding, but they're getting money from First Five and other resources as well. So those are things as well to keep in mind for your families and for your groups to be able to refer them to those type of programs. And that concludes my presentation, but I just want to make sure nobody was asleep. All right, very good. I'm impressed. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
So you mentioned some of the programs that are available that are privately funded to help immigrants, especially undocumented, access healthcare services. Are you seeing anything in the hospital for hospitals that manage to provide care that's not emergency related?
I used to work for politics, both in the Assembly and in Congress, and then I went on to the Board of Supervisors. And working in the Board of Supervisors, you get a very different perspective in part of mental health as well as substance abuse and emergency services. Having worked for legal services for over 7 years, yeah, you see some of the issues and challenges both at the hospital level when folks do go in, because how many people really know they have an emergency and it's not an emergency. And when you have a child that's crying and is in really a bit of pain and you don't know it's just an earache, you don't know that it's not some life-threatening illness. And so we always tell the families, and we talk to the hospitals when we worked with them, and I worked with them closely, is to make sure that they advise them of charity care, make sure that they link with the clinics that are across the street, because many of them are either within a couple of blocks of a hospital, walking distance usually. And so to link them with those clinics, and also we worked with the clinics to say, yeah, this is a problem with emergency medical services, but in the diagnosis part, you guys have to really partner. You have to open up those communications to be able to help the families that are most in need. And so what we would do is when we get those calls and the family would say, well, you have this $2,000 bill, then we would work with both the clinic and the hospital to partner those groups and to say, okay, there's charity care that needs to be done, and number two, you kept him in here for a bit longer than he should have, and what needs to be done. So we knew the law with regard to not only interpreter and cultural competency, because sometimes they wouldn't get interpreters. So we would address those immediately to try and negotiate and mediate a fair resolution. But it takes an effort and it takes time. And some of those advocacy groups are no longer in existence. The one that I used to work for is no longer in existence. So that is a challenge, unfortunately. Ay, hijo. He only got two.
Kind of to piggyback on
yeah.
Do you see any initiatives around education on what is an emergency and what's not? Any, education?
Yeah, I haven't seen that in my past years of advocacy. I'm hoping. I know the clinics do quite a bit. They have videos in the clinics. And the only reason I know so much more about the clinics is because I used to travel and tour them. We used to do like secret shopper type of surveys. The hospitals were a little bit more challenging in part because the waiting rooms, depending on the size, could be very expansive. And then some of them would be so crowded, it'd be a little bit more challenging for them to get the educational information out to everybody. And then in the languages needed.
Yeah.
I know that some of the hospitals were doing some outreach efforts and trying to especially address those that are repeat visitors to try and educate them and partner them with other advocacy groups, which I think is a good thing. But again, the issue of making sure that those advocacy groups stay afloat is really critical. And with these lean times, unfortunately, that's not always possible. Yes, ma'am. Right, that's correct. Yeah, it is a state by state.
But there's an issue about state only programs because the federal allows states to adopt a posture of covering a state service for those people who are under 5 years old. So for instance, the state of California actually has had a generous array of state only programs.
Yeah, but couldn't they kind of include them now into Medicaid and that they can kind of look at a function of healthcare reform?
Yeah. Well, and that's a question. That's a question that nobody might want to answer in a public face.
Yeah.
But the irony here in California is that those state-only programs are going to stay around.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And very special ones, for instance, like the prenatal care program.
Yeah.
Here, any woman, whether you're undocumented or not, you go in and for to have prenatal care, you're going to have coverage.
In terms of including the people who have been for less than 5 years in legally here in the country into the healthcare reform, like into Medicaid, and then that they can sign up for the exchange.
I think that's the case in California, but somebody can tell me.
Well, that they're currently they are. It is a state option. They are included in Medicaid program in California. Yes.
And at least, as of not right now, the state hasn't said that will continue. They simply haven't said.
Right. They've been kind of silent on that. And again, as advocacy group, but as advocacy group, Sacramento's less than a 2 hour away is a good place to start to raise those questions and make sure, especially with the exchange, as they're moving down the tracks very rapidly, to assure that they get that answered. Yes, ma'am. Charity care primarily for hospitals is the setting that I was talking about, not in the clinics. I would never say that word in conjunction with a clinic, because they already, many of them are already operating at a loss, and they're barely striving to do all the services they have. Some of the clinics that I'm aware of, like in rural California, they see 100 patients a day, and it's a small little house that's been converted to a clinic, and those folks are there first thing in the morning, lined up to get in the door. And so, no, charity care is not a word that I would use with clinics. In part, it's not that they don't do more already and don't get paid, but it's the issue of charity care with regard to the hospital, which is a law that they're supposed to provide, and also educate the people when they come in the door and they don't have insurance, that that's one of the first things that they're supposed to reveal and share with that client. That doesn't always get done. In part, you know, what happens in an emergency, you're in chaos, you're in an emergency state where you don't always capture everything. Again, it's not necessarily the fault of the hospital, but it is a means of being able to get that information to the clients. And as advocacy groups, that's one of the things we can do. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's certainly a pleasure to be here, and I'm sure all of you who are dodging the terrible situation back east are very happy to be here as well, and my certainly condolences to everybody for what they're going to be going through back there. So I'm Carmela Castellano-Garcia. I'm the president and CEO of the California Primary Care Association, and I just want to make sure you know what CPCA's role here in California. We are basically the trade association for community clinics and health centers in California. So we are the statewide voice for over 800 or really 900 sites, clinic sites throughout the state. And the mission of our association is to lead and position community clinics and health centers and their networks. They are represented by local clinic networks in California as well. And this is through advocacy, education, and services. And we try to position our health centers to be key players in the healthcare industry and ultimately to improve the health status in the communities that they serve. So our role as their association is to advocate on their behalf in Sacramento and in Washington, D.C. In California, which will be the focus of my presentation today about, you know, how the role of the health centers in California in serving the immigrant population, is we serve nearly 5 million patients a year. 3.7 million of these patients are under 200% of the federal poverty level. It's a very low-income population that we serve. And 1.6 million are uninsured. So there are certainly undocumented are a portion of the uninsured population that we see. Over 2.5 million Latinos are served by the community clinics and health centers in California, and 43% of our patients are non-English speaking. So it really depends on what part of the state you're in, but you have a place like Los Angeles where you have clinics where, you know, 95% of the clients are Latino. And then you go over to the rural northern part of California, and, you know, that would not be the case, but certainly over half statewide are Latinos in our community health centers. And I wanted to mention some of the diversity that does exist in the community health center system throughout California. We represent everything from the very small, tiny free clinics to very large, you know, community health centers over $100 million budget with, you know, 25 sites throughout multiple counties. So it's a real diversity in terms of the health center system in the state of California, and our association represents all of them. We do not represent, for example, the public hospital outpatient clinics that are associated with the Public Hospital Association. We represent the independent, licensed, nonprofit community clinics and health centers in California. So just to be clear about who we're talking about. I do want to just share briefly some of the history about how the community clinics actually came about. And community clinics really grew out of the civil rights movement and were created because the traditional healthcare marketplace wasn't serving the needs in communities throughout this country. And many of these organizations started in the 60s and the 70s with the idea that health is local, that health should, in terms of, you know, best meeting the needs of the population, they should be located where the population resides, that they should focus on care in their language that's sensitive to their culture, and certainly understanding the socioeconomic factors that impact their lives so that they're treated in a holistic manner, not as an isolated condition. And that's really the philosophy from which the community health centers arose. You may be aware that at least the federally qualified health centers, which is a very significant segment of the community health centers in California, those are the ones who are federally designated. They meet some federal requirements of being located in a medically underserved community, serving a medically underserved population. These health centers have a federal requirement that 51% of their board of directors actually be consumers, patients of the health center. And so that is kind of a hallmark of community health centers in terms of truly being having leadership that is from the community. And another important hallmark of the community health centers is that they actually do not turn anybody away, either for their ability to pay, their immigration status, whether or not they have insurance, and those are not factors. But they are required to provide those services on a sliding fee scale. So people do pay a share of costs based on their economic situation, but oftentimes those fees do not end up being collectible. People simply can't afford to pay it. But there is a sliding fee aspect. It is a portion of the revenue from community health centers. They provide primary and preventive care to patients throughout their life cycle, although in California, the health centers do predominantly serve women and children. But care is available to the entire family. And it's comprehensive. It includes everything from immunizations, cancer screening, family planning, prenatal care, mental health, dental, even acupuncture, chiropractor, and vision. And it's been seen some tremendous innovation in California. Specialty care is such a challenge to access for our population. Many health centers have been able to bring actually specialty care into the health centers and actually even provide access to specialists on site, even if it's only limited hours, limited times. But you even see more advanced specialty care happening in community health centers. So in terms of their unique services, you know, the focus is on prevention, wellness, and improved health outcomes. With healthcare reform, we're seeing a lot of emphasis on the need to have better health outcomes, and community health centers have been focusing on this for years, in part because the federal government, through HRSA, requires it. And they have been reporting clinical measures for a number of years now and focusing on issues of prevention with serious chronic conditions such as diabetes, asthma, and heart disease. These have been initiatives that have been going on in the health centers for years, with the focus being to try to provide a medical home that's really going to support the patient, modify the behaviors that negatively impact their lives. It's a big emphasis. And we're really driven to do that in part because we do see, certainly Medicaid is a big component of who we serve, but with so many uninsured as well, it is in our interest to provide people with a preventive care to try to, just like we try to keep them out of the emergency room, to try to keep their conditions under control as well, whether they're insured or not, because they are going to come back to the health center. So we need to control these chronic diseases in the entire population of the health center. It's in our financial interest ultimately to do that. So the notion of the medical home, where you want to provide the culturally competent care, patient education, trying to get the patient to take a role in their own health and make better lifestyle choices, these are all components of the kind of broad array of services that are a hallmark of community health centers. And another important aspect too is a team approach to healthcare. That they community health centers, I think, have really been leaders in a team-based model of care. We are not solely a physician-centric, in part because of just having to be innovative about how we handle workforce demands. The idea of having, you know, MAs, PAs, nurse practitioners, all that as part of a care management team has actually been something that the community health centers have been leaders in. And now with the push toward health home, really making this the way it is expected that healthcare be delivered, you know, in a lot of ways we have a leg up as we've been practicing in that manner for some time. So this is really the approach of community health centers, including case management and outreach to the population to encourage them to take advantage of these services. And there's also enabling services such as language translation and transportation. I do want to mention in terms of the immigrant population, I think it's important to acknowledge in California the role of the migrant health centers, which is one of the designations under federal law for those community health centers that serve large numbers of migrants. There have been health centers designated as migrant health centers. Their statistics show that over 700,000 of the estimated 3 million farm workers in the United States actually work in California. And we have documented that in 2009, health centers in California served 500,000 migratory workers. So the community health centers in California are playing a huge role, taking a big burden in terms of providing, taking on that care, which is really critical, and it's largely throughout the Central Valley where the migrant health centers exist in our state. So there are specific federal dollars coming into California and other states that serve the migrant population to provide these services. And so there are actually 27 migrant health centers that receive funding in California to provide care to the migrant population. But there's also CHCs that don't have migrant health center status that actually serve farm workers, but it just might not be enough to reach the threshold of being designated a migrant health center. But did want to make you aware that's a big, important program in the state of California, and our migrant health centers are playing a really critical role here. And certainly it's important in terms of our state, where agriculture is such a big, critical industry, and the migrant farm worker population is really the backbone of the workforce in our state, which is certainly benefiting the whole country, and yet they suffer, largely from terrible working conditions and also just their poor living. So a variety of illnesses that they're subject to, including higher incidence of work-related injuries, respiratory problems, eye problems, diabetes with the large Latino population. So certainly the migrant health centers are playing a very critical role in treating this high-risk population in California. Without the migrant health centers, there would certainly be far less options for the uninsured and underserved farm workers, because the public hospitals are not predominant in the Central Valley part of the state. They are in the urban core centers, mainly in California, not solely, but there is not good access to a public hospital system in the Central Valley. So these migrant health centers are a very critical resource, and their problems would go unchecked or untreated without these migrant health centers. So our community health centers throughout California are considered certainly safety net providers, but they're also considered, you know, providers of choice in many communities. And like you find in rural communities of California, where the community health center is not only the care point for the poorest low-income folks, but they're the only access point for everybody. And they are very much valued by the entire community. It's interesting the number of rural legislators who brag about, you know, the fact that their baby was born and got their prenatal care through a community health center. I mean, you know, that we are it. And so we really feel under healthcare reform, there's going to be a very important role for community health centers. We expect to have the ability to retain our patient population and ultimately attract more patients. And so this was actually recognized with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, because as Monica mentioned, the community health center program was really embraced in healthcare reform, where there was an 11 $3 billion investment made in the community health centers, and this was for their expansion. And we were really the only significant group that was called out in healthcare reform for such an investment, which I think was a real, you know, seal of approval, if you will, by Congress and the Obama administration about how important these health centers are. And I think it was also recognized that we need to continue to have that safety net for those who are going to fall through the cracks and not get covered under the Affordable Care Act. Because, you know, throughout that whole debate, you know, the issue of access to care for the undocumented, I mean, it just, it was something that ultimately got handled really through the community health centers as being an investment that would be ultimately be available to be there for all, including that part of the population. So I think that was contemplated, if not really explicitly discussed. So where are we at in terms of California, in terms of the implementation and what is the impact is going to mean for the immigrant population of California? So I want to talk about some of the key provisions and the impact that they're having, or and there's some unknowns out there, too, that kind of alluded to that I want to talk about. So a couple of the key provisions, one that to be thinking about in California is what we call the Bridge to Reform, the low-income health program. And this was an option made available to states to go ahead and start the expansion early so that the indigent adults could be covered. And it's been happening in California through the counties putting up dollars that have bring down a federal match, then ultimately to cover the uninsured adults. And so this rollout has begun in most counties in the state of California. But as was mentioned by a question in the audience, it's interesting because it's a county program. The counties are choosing who they're going to cover in this rollout. And so there are actually some counties who are including the undocumented in the LIFT program, and then there are others who are not. So that's just an interesting component, and certainly there's a lot of it's the local politics and local dollar restrictions, I'm sure, impacting all this. But this Bridge to Reform has been one place where we're seeing some disparity in terms of ultimately who's covered and who's not. And counties with this, all the financial problems that they're facing are really challenged with making this program, you know, available to large numbers of people even to begin with. But there's been over 500,000 people already enrolled in the low-income health program in California. So this is providing coverage, very significant for adults already. So it's a spotty record about what undocumented being covered or not. Another policy piece rolling out is certainly the $11 billion investment that was mentioned. And this is an opportunity for community health centers to create new health centers, so to be designated what we call a new access point or a new federally qualified health center to be created. It could be an existing clinic that becomes federally designated, meaning they get a federal grant and more significant resources. That's been the main component of the federal dollars has been to expand and create new access points. As a result of the ACA, there have been 45 new access points, new federally qualified health center designated in the state of California, which is very significant, many of them providing services to the Latino population. Of the last 25 new access point grants that came out more recently, three actually went to migrant health centers, which again gave us the opportunity to expand our services to migrant health centers. So that's the good news. I think the challenge that we're facing is the what's happening at the federal level in terms of the deficit fight and the challenges with making the $11 billion investment after 5 years really be $11 billion. And it's already not going to be. Because of the federal challenges, the first billion that was supposed to come down a year ago was already cut very significantly, several hundred million taken off of that to backfill a cut to core clinic funding. So there were not as many expansions. If there would have, we got 45, we were expecting almost double that of what we thought it was going to be. But because of the cuts and the challenges happening at the federal level, the expansion is not happening at the level originally contemplated. There was supposed to be a funding opportunity for what's called expanded medical services, which rather than creating a new clinic, it allows existing clinics to expand the numbers of physicians, to expand their hours, to expand their services, to add mental health or pharmacy. Those dollars, when the federal cut came through, they were taken off the table, and there hasn't been any expanded medical services as we had anticipated. So I think it's just important to recognize that while there's been a lot to celebrate with our 45 new access points. The expansion is not happening at the level that we had originally hoped and anticipated, and that means less services than we thought were going to be available. And right now, we are facing a prospect at the federal level during the lame duck session of having an additional $162 million cut to the core funding of community health centers. And so we're back there lobbying. We will be over the month of November in particular, really trying to protect our program. And with what's happening at the federal level, I mean, everything could be on the table, including Medicaid. So it's not just the community health centers at stake. There is a lot happening at the federal level. And I think it just points to the need to be vigilant. Obviously, I think we all know with the election going on, there's a lot of unknowns in health care reform. But I do want to point out that no matter what party we see at the federal level, that there, because of the federal deficit, there are challenges with being able to secure that $11 billion investment. So that is something that we are very mindful of and continue to do very significant advocacy around. Another piece to keep in mind in terms of California, as was mentioned, there's the state-only programs that are in existence. Well, not only do we have a budget challenge at the federal level, we have a very significant budget crisis at the state level. I know California is not the only one. I'm sure many of you come from states where you're facing your own challenges. It's just the magnitude of everything gets multiplied in California. So at the election coming up, we're facing the prospect if a governor's tax initiative doesn't go through and doesn't look good, where there's going to need to be additional, cuts in the billions. And what's going to get cut? I mean, we're very concerned. Certainly education's on the chopping block just by the nature of the initiative itself. But they're going to have to be looking at additional cuts. And so we are very concerned about our immigrant-only programs and what is the future of healthcare going to be in this current budget environment that we're facing in California. And the question that was asked about the categorical funding. I mean, in California, we have got some incredible funding that supports immigrant health. We've got the Family Pact program, which is an amazing federal waiver program that provides family planning, and that includes contraception screening and treatment for STDs, adolescents at risk. And the Family Pact program is very significant, and it does support undocumented women. We've got the Child Health and Disability Prevention program, the AIM program. I mean, we are going to have to be vigilant about these programs going forward in terms of any that have a state funding component about whether the state's going to continue to fund these dollars. So, maybe there have been some winks, but I don't think we're feeling confident about that and confident about the future, especially in this budget environment. The concern would be that the programs that support immigrant women will be vulnerable. So that is something that we're very much watching for in the state of California. Another thing that I think on the more positive or opportunity side is really it was mentioned about the public hospitals and primary care, really the need for more collaboration. The whole idea of local delivery system transformation. There is a lot of exciting things happening. There are incentives as a result of healthcare reform for hospitals to be looking more to what happens to their patients when they're discharged, to make sure they don't come back. And those incentives are having hospitals look a little differently at primary care. It is so unfortunate in our state how fragmented the system is and that the community health centers, have the collaboration between the hospital and the clinic systems has not been at all ideal. And there are, some more places where it happens in a better way, but the systems have really been challenged. Well, now that there's incentives, we are seeing more hospitals, both private and public, approaching the community clinic systems about the potential for collaboration, whether it's ACO formation or just innovative projects to try to keep people out of the emergency room and in preventive care. And we really hope to see more of that going forward. So I think the ACA has created an opportunity. There aren't as many health centers, for example, involved in ACOs as we would have originally thought, but there's some. And there's a few health centers that are actually leading that conversation, which has to include the hospital component of the system. So I think that's a place where there is opportunity, and I've been pleased to see definitely some movement and more potential collaboration and discussion happening, and I hope that that ultimately results in some great projects here in the state of California that should improve the system of care for everybody. And when it comes to the public hospital system, which is taking a big burden of the emergency care for the undocumented, it only makes sense to collaborate with the community health centers who are going to be committed to, are providing primary care for that population. But finding ways to do that, you know, it takes a lot, having referral systems. You know, it's not an easy thing to do, especially in a historically fragmented system. It really takes an effort. So, we hope to see more of that because it really makes the most sense for the patients. And ultimately for the system as well. So really, I think to wrap up, I think while we do have a lot to celebrate, certainly there is a lot of room for improvement. And when it comes to the immigrant population, I mean, Monica went over all the things that, you know, people are continue to be left out of. And so that's why it's so critical that the community health centers, you know, maintain our role to be there. I want to share an interesting statistic, however, about who is going to remain uncovered after the ACA. And this is a very recent study that came out showing that somewhere between 3 and 4 million Californians could remain uninsured after the law is fully implemented. But the interesting finding in this report is that only 25% of them are going to be undocumented immigrants. And it turns out that the lion's share of people who remain uninsured are going to be those who are eligible but not enrolling in the programs to which they're eligible for. In a way, that's not a surprise because we've had so many challenges with getting people enrolled in programs like Medi-Cal. The eligible but not enrolled is a big issue in our state, but it appears that it's going to continue to be down the line. And it's also estimated that of those who are going to remain uninsured, 66% will be Latino. Again, not surprising, because when you look at who's eligible but not enrolled in Medi-Cal right now, it's Latinos. So, and plus we're the portion we are certainly of the undocumented. So it's not surprising that 66% are going to be Latino who continue to be left out with the portion of that undocumented. So I just wanted to point out that recent study, because it's an interesting finding that has, you know, kind of people scratching their heads that, oh, it's not only the undocumented who are going to be left out. We're going to have a significant issue with reaching those who are eligible. And I think that points to the issue of the importance for outreach, for targeted outreach to the Latino and non-English speaking population that are going to have access to the Medi-Cal program and access through the exchange. Those that we're going to need to make sure that we're really reaching out to that population. So certainly, healthcare reform has been a great victory, but there's still a lot of work to be done. And what we have to do in our state, and I'm sure in yours too, is continue to be vigilant. Vigilant about the federal dollars, vigilant about what's going to happen to healthcare reform, certainly after the election, so many unknowns. Vigilant about what's happening in your state to those state-only programs, like if you've got prenatal care for undocumented women. What an incredible program. Got to hang on to that. You know, innovative programs like Family Pact, so we got to be vigilant about making sure that we can maintain those particular programs. And ultimately, to be vigilant about ensuring that you're supporting your community health center and your public hospital system. If you're advocates for the immigrant population in your state, this is the system of care that is there. And I know people, there's challenges with some of the capacity issues in terms of just getting people in to the community health centers can be a challenge. And health centers are, let me tell you right now, they are really being pushed to really look at their systems and look at issues like wait times, look at issues for the population, because they're going to have to be more competitive for everybody. So I think we're going to be seeing system improvements. And it's amazing to me when I go around to the health centers and what they're gearing up to be a health home. And, you know, these 3-month wait times are not going to cut it in environment and health care reform. And that's for everybody. Despite what your status is. So I think we're going to see some improvements in what community health centers can do. They're being driven as well to be more efficient, ultimately to see more people. So they are poised to be the providers of care going forward, and we really look forward to your support in helping keep the community health system strong in our country. Thank you.
Of the Board of Latino Coalition, of which Carmela is vice chair, and obviously the Muttmeyer director, and also the director for the California Program of Access to Care, which is the lead player in the health equity public hospital conference. I want to make sure that you know, you recognize that this particular session is part of the health equity and public hospital.
I mentioned that.
But I had actually a question, because it was kind of alluded to, but you didn't specifically, there's a certain value about FQHCs, the federally qualified health centers. And not all clinics, if you will, are FQHCs, but a great preponderance, particularly all the large ones here in California, and most of the large ones across the country. So the value of preserving that FQHC process to the community clinics and to the underserved. Carmel?
Yeah, I mean, and that's really, when I talk about preserving the federal dollars, because that $11 billion investment is actually only for federally qualified health centers, either to create new ones or if we ever get the expanded medical services dollars to expand services within existing ones. And I think Gil's making a good point that FQHC status, and we actually have studies in California that show that the financial health of clinics is stronger in federally qualified health centers because they do get so many benefits from being federally designated. It's not only an ongoing federal grant, it's Federal Torts Claim Act, it's access to pharmaceuticals through the 340B program. I mean, it's just there's a whole range of obligations that come with it, which can be very taxing and challenging, and they're highly regulated, but many have determined that the benefits far outweigh that. So I think when it's really important to also maintain a robust free and community clinic component as well, which CPCA also represents. Those are the clinics who have not yet been designated as federally qualified health centers, and they are operating under some very challenging conditions. For example, one of the benefits of being an FQHC is that you are reimbursed under Medicaid under an enhanced Medicaid rate. It's called the PPS rate. We don't get those dismally low Medi-Cal rates that you hear about, lowest in the country. But for the community clinics who are not federally designated, they are living off those low fee-for-service rates. So there are certainly some challenges faced by those clinics that are not yet federally designated. So we really need to support both ends of the system, but the federal discussion and the federal fight and the federal dollars are really about FQHCs, and they do have a very critical role. So yeah, thank you for pointing that out.
And then as our health reform and ORCA became set, the money started to roll in, my agency cut the site that we used to do for 10 years, so the day laborers completely cut it. And I fought for it and tried to get people to fight for it in terms of the way our structuring of our health reform, it incentivizes Medicare and Medicaid dollars, of course, through the patient-centered primary care home. And I guess I just didn't know, besides telling my agency that this community matters and they should still value it, they seem to be going towards the new dollars that are easier to get and forgetting this community completely. And just wondering if you have any advice or thoughts on that situation.
Well, that's interesting, because one of the a way to get extra points in the competition, because it's highly competitive, the federal dollars, was having a special population. So actually, when the new federal dollars, the $11 billion investment, part of the reason we got those three health center new access points that I mentioned, mm-hmm. California did very well in that round because we had so many special population, specifically it was the farm workers. So I don't know if they evaluated that and determined that for whatever reason they didn't meet a certain threshold, but that's unfortunate if they missed that opportunity, because it actually could have given them a leg up in the competition to be designated as a migrant health center. So I would say that maybe a way that you could re-raise the issue, because there should be more rounds, and I believe the special population will continue to be a favoring factor, that maybe you should just make sure that has been evaluated or encouraged that it would be, about whether going for a migrant health center designation for that site makes sense. So I would really encourage you at least look into that.
Especially with the changing populations of Oregon, before it used to be a certain segment of society, and that's really changing over the past 20 years or so. It's become they have a lot more, you see Mestecos as well as Latino populations that are there. So I think those changes can also be utilized as well as in your competition to get this money.
Thanks.
Just a
question.
I'd like to locate the report that you mentioned, the report
The new, yeah, the report out of the UC Berkeley, what's his,
Ken Jacobs. Center for Labor Research.
UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research. If you send me an email, I'll give you my card, I can get it to you directly, but I'm sure you can download it online. But yeah, Ken Jacobs is the author, and it just came out in the last month, I believe. It's an excellent report. I highly encourage you to look at it.
Did you get a briefing on it, right?
Yes, absolutely. The clinics are equipped to and focus on the border regions. Certainly tuberculosis is an issue that they are well prepared to identify and target and understand. And HIV, the clinics, many of them have access to the Ryan White Care Dollars even, and some have HIV programs. So yes, those are issues that the health centers focus on. Very good point. Well, in terms of specialty care, I don't want to paint too rosy of a picture here, because you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm so pleased when I talk about the innovations that I have seen in health centers, bringing the specialists in. You know, not all the health centers have the resources or space to be able to do that, but where I see it happening, huge benefit to the community. But the issue of accessing specialists for our Medi-Cal population is hard enough. Now talk about the undocumented and uninsured. You know, you have doctors begging their friends in the community to, this is a real morale issue even for the clinicians working in community health centers when they can't get access to specialty care for their patients. So it continues to be a very challenging situation. What health care reform is going to do is increase the Medi-Cal rates for 2 years. And the hope is that this will result in greater access and more specialists participating in the program. So it will remain to be seen whether that happens, but that is a very important provision of healthcare reform. So we'll see how that ultimately plays out. Another piece about the system, I mean, you're absolutely right, and there is, I forget how many, $700 million has been invested by the exchange in the computer system that is going to be resulting in the no wrong door, one-stop shop way to sign up for healthcare. And online, you know, in terms of the exchange, and an interesting report, though, came out that kind of intrigued me, because I've always been concerned about the online, you know, buying everything on the exchange online, because you think about access to the internet for our community. But just some interesting data I've seen recently that, for example, in California, for Latina moms with kids, the cell phone usage and their use of the smartphones and browsing the web is just, you know, much higher than I ever would have thought or expected. So they're, you know, at least the smartphone revolution is maybe helping with some of that. And an interesting study came out recently by the Field Poll, which broke it down by ethnicity and was asking people about healthcare reform. And one of the questions was what they thought about the exchange and what they thought about having to go online to shop for your insurance at the exchange, and it was Latinos who were overwhelmingly the most interested in saying that they would pursue online shopping for the exchange. And I just found that fascinating because I wouldn't have expected that, more so than whites, Asians, and any other ethnic group, the Latinos. It could be because so many are uninsured that anyway they can get their care. You know, they'd be open to, I don't know. But so maybe there's just some more promising things about what it'll mean for online access for the Latino community. But, you know, California doesn't have a great track record about computer systems and enrollment, and streamlined enrollment has not been our strength. Having an integrated system for enrollment is never how it's been done. So this is going to be a miracle. I mean, someone, one of the officials on the exchange told me, oh my God, it's a $700 billion investment. And I said, it's going to be worth it if it works. You know, it can revolutionize getting people enrolled. But, you know, there's so many unknowns. I don't know. So I'm kind of excited about the prospect of it.
Yeah. Bill?
Let's keep in mind, with respect to the exchanges across the country, okay, there are going to be monies available from the federal government through the exchanges to do outreach enrollment. Obviously, California is a huge state, but we're going to have $40 million available, starting with an RFP next month.
Mm-hmm.
That will be designed for outreach and enrollment. Okay.
Yes.
You do it, it's done two $20 million segments. And that's the process that you need to follow in your own states to make sure when your exchange gets that money, that you push and prod them to do the right job with respect to enrollment and outreach. Because that's
excellent
what we're trying
point.
To do with California. Latino Coalition, CPAC, or a variety of organizations. Get them to do the right thing. The design, we know how to design it. The question is whether they're going to do it right.
Right, and that is really critical in part because we've been to the exchange meetings on a monthly basis, and that's one of the things that we keep raising a concern of, is to make sure that that outreach and enrollment dollars are targeting those populations most in need. With regard to your question, with regard to what's going to happen with the specialty care, there are communities out there that are already making the transition on specialty care through telemedicine, and part of the issue that they're experiencing, it's going to be successful. They're having success in LA and other areas as well. But part of the challenges is just educating the Latino population and other ethnic groups, threshold language groups, of the use of telemedicine. You know, not a lot of us are used to talking into a TV. And so just getting over that educational part, I think that's going to be another way to be able to reduce the waiting time. Specialty care clinics are using them as well as hospitals in partnership, and so some of those waiting times, which were 6 months, 9 months, a year, are now being reduced to 3 months, 2 months, 6 months, and so you'll see that. And I think as that expands, you'll see more opportunity for specialty care in a shorter period of time. But it's the technology that needs to get to those places. And like I said, some of those clinics in the rural communities, they're so isolated, they are the primary care facilities for those sites. So those are some of the ones that are being outreached to as far as telemedicine as well, because they can't bring in a specialty care person. You know, they just won't go and live there for prolonged periods of time. They'll leave. And so how to be able to do with the best that you have and the dollars you have and the limited resources you have, they're doing other things with regard to technology.
Thank you all for your presentation today. I'm especially interested in what you have to say because I'm representing a nonprofit hospital in Kansas City, Missouri. We have a huge population of undocumented immigrants who will be ineligible for all of these provisions that we talked about today. And so as I prepare to present to our executive board, and I'm really going to make a push for, we need to have a plan for how we're going to deal with these people. And we do have progressive leadership. They're not risk takers, but they're willing to hear me out. My question to you guys is, do you see hospitals, or have you had contact with hospitals who have active policies or ways that they do handle undocumented people who come through their doors? We've thrown around a lot of things on the table. You know, do we raise money and set aside a fund specifically for undocumented people? I mean, right now, they call us, we go in there, and then we hustle. We call our friends down the street at the safety net clinic. We try to do this, that, and the other thing to get people care. I'm curious because I'd love to see my hospital, and I think they'd be open to doing it, having an active policy, but do they exist in hospitals?
There's different types of programs, and I'll let both of them speak, but the ones that I know of are, some of them are from the system development, some are from LA as well, and they have an industry care plan within their counties, and they're usually operated by the counties, and they're either contracted with the hospitals or with their local clinics, and what they end up doing is they end up capturing that population to provide that care. In essence, when they go to the hospital and they incur that debt, the Indigent Care Services call a medically indigent services program or plan, project, whatever you want to call it, and they provide that kind of extra coverage that they wouldn't normally have, and they also cover undocumented. Not all counties cover undocumented. Some of them elect, as Gil said earlier, not to address that population, while other counties may be a little bit more progressive. So look at those counties that have those policies in place and mimic them. Fresno County has it, Merced County has it. Can't remember what kind in LA, but if you give me your business card, I'll get that to you. And so they partnership with the clinics and they partnership with the hospitals to be able to make sure that that population is covered.
My response was just to piggyback on what you said was I think a lot of what hospitals are going to be doing is going to be very state specific, and I'll be happy to give you my card because I think we're going to delve into this issue even more as an organization in APH in the future, and I'll be happy to keep you abreast of what we find.
I think you're also going to see a lot more folks, especially in the state of California, utilizing and accessing that charity care component that's available at the hospital.
And I would recommend actually the California Association of Public Hospitals. Offhand don't know what the innovative programs are, but I know some are working more closely with the clinics, for example, than others. But through maybe Erica Murray at the California Association of Public Hospitals, they might be able to point out a couple of good examples in California of what innovative hospitals. I think that would be a good way to go.
Thank you very much. I live in a rural county Northern California, and I'm wondering if you know of any communities that are being especially successful as a rural community, because we have one community health system and one hospital system, and so that's not much to work with in terms of diversity of players. So if the hospital system decides, like, no, we really don't, want to do ABC, we're kind of left, okay, we'll keep pressuring. But are any rural counties especially successful? I'd love to model them.
I think you might want to look at some of the rural counties that didn't have the LIFT program, like Central Valley. Get a hold of Norma Forbes with HCAP, and then give me your business card, give me her name. She has a wealth of experience in that arena. And in addition, part of what Fresno County faced was just that. You got the hospital saying, I don't want to do this, and you got the county saying, we want to do that, the clinic saying, we want to do these other things. So you have this pyramid, this triangle, nobody was moving. So we ended up getting community leaders to then bring these folks back to the table to say, enough's enough, the impact, negative impact on the community is so great that movement has to occur. So then they started another dialogue. And sometimes it's just mixing up the players at the table to be able to get the right combination of the people that they feel comfortable enough to discuss it. But I'll give you her contact information. She'll be able to at least walk you through that path.
I think Shasta County is a really excellent model due to some leadership, I think, between the Clinic Association up there, which is the Health Alliance for Northern California, and I think pretty progressive leadership at the county level, that they have had everything from county-wide discussions around the healthcare delivery transformation, around the mental health system. But another place where it's really come to light in terms of what difference it makes to see people working together is around the whole rural transition to managed care that's happening in California, where 28 rural counties that currently do not have managed care are being designated to have managed care. And what's been fascinating is that the state of California intended to have an RFP that would contract with one or two or several health plans for all 28 counties. But it's because the counties led by, I think, the Shasta region and then seven surrounding counties, so 8 out of the 28 counties got together and determined that they didn't want that. They wanted a county-organized health system, which would bring in an existing partnership health plan, which exists outside that region, and bring it in. Well, they got the Board of Supervisors in all 8 of those counties to endorse the idea of a county-organized health system. They started advocating as, like, the 8 counties telling the state, no, we don't want to do it that way. We want this. And the state was pretty resistant. And I was at a stakeholder meeting where the state said, no, we're not doing that. Well, they got a legislature to introduce legislation that would have mandated it. They, hit really hard. And next thing you know, the legislator withdrew his bill, and the state is saying they're open to looking at that option. We'll see what happens in the RFP, but I kind of saw it as a cult. First, I saw Shasta for a couple of years doing all this innovative community-wide hospital clinics, everybody coming together. And then next thing you know, you see the power of that when they pull off something like what they're doing impacting state policy. So I really think Shasta, from what I've seen, have been real leaders in the state in the rural area.
Did someone not I think somebody else back there had their hand up.
Yeah. I'm just going to comment on her question. I'm also from a nonprofit hospital in California. We have a very unique relationship with our local group clinic, which is now federally qualified. But we provide community benefit grants for our community benefit programs for operations with individuals that would otherwise come to the hospital.
Another piece of information regarding this question is talk to CNSP, run by a guy named Zeke Kemper, who knows more on the subject than virtually anybody I know. And he has, I believe it's 28 counties that, under an aggregate lit program. So lead effort, Google CNSP, comma, Zeke Kemper, K-E-M-P-E-R.
And you have our contact on the PowerPoint and the file, so feel free to give us a call or email. I have an extensive board and kind of my landfill, just some of the ones that are serving on our board. But we have, in combination with all our board, over 250 years of health policy and care experience. So I don't know the answers. I pick up the phone and call these folks because they're the masters of it and the experts of it.